When it comes to fruit, Mother Nature seldom gets it just right. And so people fiddle around with her creations, trying to craft a fruit that looks, smells, feels, and tastes just right. A fruit so perfect it might, just might, generate millions of dollars in the marketplace. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to tune in the food chain, because today we are going in search of the perfect fruit.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 648th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Fruitvale, Chile, who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Howdy.
And producer Carol Stafford on the phone. Hello, Carol.
Hello there.
Folks, when it comes to fiddling around with Mother Nature's fruit, few can match the industry of Modesto, California's Floyd Zager. Zager's family-owned Zager's Genetics has patented over 200 varieties of fruit, all developed through the hand pollination of his mother plants. Though Zager's work might appear eccentric to some, others see him as an astute businessman reaching for the brass ring of horticulture. While the big sellers in the fruit marketplace are the traditional staples like bananas, apples, and oranges, newer exotic fruits like mangoes and papayas are bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars every year. And still newer exotics like the Meyer lemon and the mandarin orange are muscling their way onto the supermarket shelves as well. Floyd Zager strides into this marketplace with something new. It's a cross between a plum and an apricot, and it's sweet and beautiful. Could this pluot be the perfect fruit? Here to help us cook up an answer, we have Chip Brantley, who is the author of The Perfect Fruit, Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and The Hunt for the Elusive Pluot. Welcome aboard, Chip. Good to have you on the Food Chain today.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's great to be here.
Good. And you're coming to us today from Alabama?
That's right. I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and I heard that weather report. 73, high 73. Sounds great.
Yeah, it's just about perfect in Santa Cruz, California.
Right.
Except for the fires we've been having.
Right.
Life has been really good. So, do you remember the first time you tasted a pluot?
I do. I remember it well. I was I used to live in Los Angeles and was working in Culver City and near the Sony film lot, and there weren't a whole lot of restaurants around there at the time, and so... It was in 2000, right around this time, early August. Culver City had a farmer's market every Tuesday, and I'd walk over there for lunch most Tuesdays. And I, one Tuesday, happened to pick up this yellow plum-looking piece of fruit and had a bite of it, and that was my first experience with it. It was a little overripe, but it was incredibly sweet. Just, you know, the stereotypical picture of a person eating a piece of juicy stone fruit. The juice went everywhere, dripped on my chin.
There it is. And, Eureka, I found it, right?
I fell victim to the cliche.
Yeah.
And from that point forward, just kind of wanted to know as much as I could about it.
And, of course, wanting to know as much as you could about the pluot took you to Floyd Zager's Modesto operation, right?
That's right. Yeah. So... found out a little bit about it that summer, and then, you know, cruelly had eaten my first pluot just as the season was ending. So the next summer, I'd moved up to the Bay Area, San Francisco, and for my girlfriend's birthday, ended up taking her out to what I called at the time the birthplace of pluots, out to Zager Genetics, which is outside Modesto.
No, that's an interesting birthday present to get a girl.
Well, luckily she loved pluots and still does love pluots. She's not my wife, so it may have sealed the deal. Who knows?
Yeah, there you go. It's a little bit of sweetness to seal the deal.
That's right.
So, you know, before we get into Floyd Zager, he's not the only famous Bay Area wide breeder of plants, is he?
No, you know, there are a bunch of...
Going back some time, we run into probably the most famous of all, Luther Burbank.
That's right. He was up in Santa Rosa, California, by way of grew up in Massachusetts, and then when he was in his early 20s, he decided to head out to California, and he ended up in San Francisco in the Bay Area for a while, and then went up and started his own nursery and breeding operation up in Santa Rosa, became known as the Wizard of Santa Rosa, and he is, like you said, the kind of the father of really fruit breeding, not only in this country, but probably around the world.
Right.
And was one of the first people to import Asian plums into the U.S., which pretty much is the Asian plums are kind of the foundation of most of the plums we eat now.
Okay, give us a thumbnail on how we went from the Asian plum to the Santa Rosa plum.
Well, so let's see. Burbank, once he settled in, there were several nurserymen importing plums from Japan at that time. And Burbank grew some of those at his nursery, and he liked them so much, and he happened to be at the Maritime Museum in San Francisco, and he saw a record of a sailor who described this, what he called the blood plum of Satsuma. It was a red flesh plum, and Burbank liked the sound of that, so he imported 12 different red flesh plums. And just started working with him on his breeding grounds. And in the early 20th century, like around 1904, 1905, somewhere in there, he released the Santa Rosa plum. And that Santa Rosa plum is, many people consider, you know, the foundational plum for pretty much every plum now.
Right.
And it still is. You know, there's some people out there who insist that there's not been an improvement on plum since then.
And there it was. So that's and Luther Burbank also, of course, is well known for his work with potatoes, right?
Right, that's right. That was his first sort of big hit. That's what enabled him to head out to California. He was in Massachusetts at the time, and bred what eventually would become the standard russet potato, the Burbank russet, and didn't make a ton of money off of it. He only made about $150 off of it, which was, you know, a good sum then, but not a ton.
Right.
And he, at the time, there was no patent protection for fruit breeders or plant breeders, and so he basically just sold the rights to the thing to a nursery, and took the $150 and his potatoes, and he set out for California.
Now, tell us a little bit about the Plant Patent Act, and this, of course, is really what made the industry boom, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. So Zager, I keep saying Zager when I mean Burbank. Burbank spent his entire life without any patent protection for any new varieties.
So all of his work was not patented.
That's
not
right.
Patented. There was no protection there at all.
That's right. And that there are many stories of fruit breeders and plant breeders who, you know, would develop a new variety. It would take off. They'd make some money off of it for about two or three years, and then somebody else could, you know, propagate the variety in greater numbers and sell it and become known for selling that variety, even though they weren't the ones who bred it. There's a kind of the classic example is the guy who bred the Concord grape. He bred it. He actually grew up right around where Burbank grew up in Massachusetts, central Massachusetts, and bred the Concord grape and made a few bucks of it for a couple of years, and then noticed that sales were dwindling after a few years, and some other nursery had kind of taken over and made a fortune off of the grape, and eventually created what would become Welch's Grape Juice.
Wow!
And actually, there's a great book called Banvard's Folly, written by a guy named Paul Collins, which tells that story in great detail.
What was the title again?
Banvard's Folly. Banvard, apostrophe S, Folly.
And the story of the Concord grape? And
well, he tells the story of a bunch of history's losers.
Oh, good. that would be a big one, though.
So it's a great book. I love that book. But so this was happening, you know, for a long time with plant fruit breeders, and Burbank was slow to kind of come around to the idea of patent protection, and eventually, after, you know, as he was nearing the end of his career, a movement was really beginning to take hold, and he had kind of a change of heart. He was on record many times as saying, you know, he fruit breeding, plant breeding was not something that he would encourage anyone to get into because it just, you know, just is such hard work on its own and with so little
return.
That's right.
But with patent protection, it's similar to copyrights, I suppose. You create something, you own it, then you can license it to other people and collect royalties, right?
That's right, yeah. It's actually, the patent protects you from other people claiming that work. So it's not so much ownership as it is a protection from having any competition on that for, it's now 17, actually I think they've extended it to 20 years, it used to be 17 years.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We have Chip Brantley, who is the author of The Perfect Fruit, with us today. We're talking about the search for the Pluot. We're talking about Floyd Zager. We're talking about Luther Burbank. What's your favorite fruit? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, I remember my first taste of a Pluot, like author Chip Brantley, author of The Perfect Fruit. I was at a farmer's market, and somebody offered me a slice of this interesting-looking thing, and I popped it into my mouth like I do so many things at the farmer's market, and it was delicious. It was sweet, and it was firm, and it was just right. It was the perfect fruit. So where did that Pluot come from? That's what we're looking for today, and we have author Chip Brantley with us. The Perfect Fruit, and we're talking a little bit about Luther Burbank before the times when plant breeders were able to protect their work with a patent, and then there was the Plant Patent Act. When was that, Chip? Do you remember, or do you have any idea when the Plant Patent Act was?
It was late 1920s, early 1930s. I'm not sure the exact year, but it was... Burbank died in 1926, and it was after he died. So it was a few years after he died.
So like many farmers, he lived poor but died rich.
That's right. Well, no, it actually, I think he probably died poor too.
Yeah, died poor too.
He
sure left a legacy.
He did.
For the world that lives on today in Santa Rosa plum. And what was the name of the potato?
Well, the Burbank potato was what it was called, and then a sort of offshoot of that potato that he bred became the sort of standard russet potato that you know, the McDonald's of the world uses their French fry potato.
Right.
And not only did he leave those varieties, but also just left these sort of building blocks for, like I said, pretty much the entire plum industry as we know it.
Well, you know, let's pick it up kind of after World War II, because that World War II kind of marked a sea change in our food chain, and we kind of went from local foods to supermarket foods.
Right.
And with that, we lost some of the flavor in our fruits. And what happened to the flavor?
Well, I think generally speaking, as fruit had to travel longer distances to get to these supermarkets and had to last longer in transportation and then on the shelves, we growers and breeders began to prize different other qualities and flavor, things like durability and appearance. And I think that still continues.
I guess when it comes to the mass market, the standard of quality is uniformity. Everybody wants it to look exactly the same.
Right, and also just, you know, just the we buy with our eyes, you know.
Right.
And so I think, you know, one of the problems that everybody talks about, that I think the sort of epitome of this trend is the Red Delicious apple, which
isn't anymore.
Right.
It's okay. Red, but it's red. Not too delicious. What happened to the flavor in the Red Delicious apple?
Well, I think that's a great case of I'm not a Red Delicious apple expert, I should say, but I think what happened there is what has happened to a lot of fruit, is they just breed for things other than flavor. They breed for durability, they breed for size, they breed for appearance, and we begin to lose flavor in that process, lose aroma.
And it seems as though that Red Delicious apples are always the most beautiful thing on the supermarket shelf. But when you buy them, it's just such a disappointment because there's no flavor left in them.
That's right. And I think that trend was happening to a varying degree with pretty much all
fruits,
And you definitely saw that with plums and peaches and nectarines. And that was one time I was at the Zegers, and they said there's kind of a generational divide that they've noticed, and that Dave Wilson Nursery, which is the nursery that has partnered with the Zegers to propagate their varieties, but somebody was saying that there's really a generational divide between people who like their fruit juicy like their plums juicy, and people who like their plums crunchy, and that I think has a lot to do with you know, whether you grew up eating plums that were grown nearby, whether you grew up eating plums that were shipped in.
So if you grew up in the time when there were plums growing nearby, you're probably used to juicy plums.
That's right.
And if you're used to buying your plums in the city supermarket, you're probably used to the real hard varieties then.
Well, that was what was so shocking to me the first time I had a pluot, and I think one of the reasons that I took to the pluots so quickly and so strongly was that I don't think I'd ever had a good plum. You know, I mean, growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm not sure that I'd ever eaten a plum that was...
Yeah, they need some cool, don't they?
What's that?
They need some cool weather, don't they?
I mean, we definitely have plums here, but they're mostly for jarring and making jams and that sort of thing. And, so I'm not sure that even from the grocery store I'd ever had a good plum. I mean, you know, the people on the East Coast and down south are always complaining about the apricots, and I don't think I've ever had a good apricot at a grocery store. I don't think it's possible. So I think, and that I don't know if that'll ever be solved, the apricot problem. But I think with plums and with a lot of fruit, kind of going back to what we were talking about, I think so much of it just was the what they bred for was not flavor for so long. I had one grower say to me one time that flavor was so unimportant for so long that some growers wouldn't even bother to taste a variety before they decided to grow it, because that just wasn't an issue in terms of what grocery stores are looking for.
Well, that's kind of amazing to me that a grower would buy trees to plant to grow a crop to sell, and he never tasted the fruit because it was unimportant.
I think, well, that's secondhand, that comment, but I think it underlies kind of what I mean, these commercial growers are at the mercy of what supermarkets will buy. And I think if they're looking for, you know, if you're looking for a late season variety that holds up well and is black skinned and has so and so other qualities, then flavor is just so low on the list. If you just sort of assume it has a baseline decent flavor, then, you know, why taste it?
Well, you know, I'm not saying it reflects poorly on the grower, because they're just doing business. You know, what it reflects poorly on is we consumers.
That's right.
Who've lost our taste.
Right.
That's what's frightening to me.
And don't demand it.
And don't demand it, yeah. So
right.
As long as it looks pretty, it doesn't have to taste good.
Right, that's right.
Now, how do... It would seem like there would be a market for a fruit that looked pretty and also tasted good.
You hope so.
Now, are breeders not addressing that issue?
Well, I think that's one of the...
I mean, like, take a red apple, for example, a red delicious apple that looks beautiful, ships well, but tastes like nothing.
Right.
And isn't it possible to breed taste back into that apple?
Well, I think that's happened. I mean, I think, you know, I think it was interesting talking to stone fruit growers in California because so many of them, unprompted, would bring up the apple industry. I think that's both a function of envy because apples are, you can store them forever.
Right.
They're durable. And they also, in terms of marketing apples, we consumers and grocery stores market them by name, market them by variety, so it makes it easier for consumers to
know the difference,
find what they're looking for, exactly. Mm-hmm. Know what they're going to get and find what they're looking for. Whereas with plums and, plums specifically, you know, we have red plums and black plums. That's pretty much it. And within those two broad categories, you get all kinds of different tastes and textures. And so plum growers would talk jealously of apple growers that way, but I think also they look at the apple industry as something of a cautionary tale because apple growers favor the red delicious so heavily that the bottom fell out of the market, both because of the volume of the variety and also because
there wasn't any taste left of the apples.
That's right. Consumers just got sick of it.
Oh, thank you, we said. I've had enough, and I can't remember the last time I bought a red delicious apple. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Chip Brantley, who's the author of The Perfect Fruit, Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and The Hunt for the Elusive Pluot. And he found the pluot at Floyd Zager's in Modesto, California. And when we get back, we'll go visit Floyd Zager in Modesto, California. Do stay tuned. Hey, we're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Chip Brantley. We're on a search for the perfect fruit, and we're looking at Floyd Zager's Zager Genetics over in Modesto, California. Gosh, when I started working on my book Metro Farm way back when, Floyd Zager was legendary then, and he's still legendary today, having produced the pluot, which is his plant. It's patented by him, and it's out there in the world. And matter of fact, Floyd has patented over 200 varieties of plants. What does that mean in the marketplace, Chip? Let's see here. I got to press the button, dummy me here. Hold on. There we are. What does it mean when he has a patent on the pluot, right?
That's right. Well, he actually, the name pluot is a privately owned trademark. So that the Zagers own the name Pluot, and that refers to their plum apricot hybrid trees.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a mouthful. And then the patents apply to each individual variety. So they'll have a variety that say a bunch of growers want to grow, or some grower has tested and really likes and wants to take it out there into the marketplace. The Zagers will patent that variety, and they'll give it a varietal name like Dapple Dandy or Flavor Fall or something along those lines, and they'll apply for the patent, and then that variety will sort of be theirs for a certain amount of time. That variety will be, in essence, owned by them for a number of years.
So they get a royalty on the plant?
They get royalties on tree sales, that's right.
On tree sales.
Right. So that they work with a nursery in Hickman, California, kind of the foothills of the Sierras, east of Modesto.
Up there above the fog?
Up there, yeah, right. I think they've got now, I think Dave Wilson is now one of the large, if not the largest, tree fruit nursery maybe in the world, but definitely in the state and the country. And they have a lot of land all over the place. But they, Dave Wilson will take that variety, he'll take wood from that variety, and they'll propagate it in great numbers and then sell directly to growers. And then the growers will plant them, and that's how they end up out in the grocery stores and to us.
So it'll take us back to Floyd Zager's place and
sure.
Tell us how he went about developing the pluot and some of it. How many, 200 plant patents, but he also has probably thousands of different kinds of varietals growing, right?
He does. He started, Zager got a start back in the 50s working for a man named Fred Anderson, who, stretching this back to Burbank, had apprenticed with Luther Burbank up in Santa Rosa and then moved down to San Joaquin Valley. And Anderson is now sort of his what he's known as is the father of the modern nectarine. He was the first person to kind of breed some size into nectarines and really popularize nectarines.
Mm-hmm.
So Zager got a start there. He worked there in the late 50s for a couple of years. And before that, he had just been, as a hobby almost, breeding azaleas and rhododendra. And he had turned it into a little bit of a business before he went off to work for Anderson. But after 2 years, two seasons with Anderson, he realized that... He's a fruit guy. He said, as he's told many people, he was bitten by the dreaded disease of fruit breeding. And so he came back to Modesto, and while running the plant nursery, the azalea nursery, and eventually kind of blossomed out into a full-on ornamental nursery and even a landscaping service, all sorts of stuff, he and his family worked on the fruit breeding kind of almost on the side. So it was almost a moonlighting type thing. And he at first started working on peaches and nectarines. His first plant patent was in the mid-60s, and it was a peach. And in the late 60s and early 70s, he got into white flesh peaches and nectarines, and he's generally credited with kind of creating that industry in the U.S. It was big in Europe, and he took a trip to Europe in the late 60s and saw some of these varieties and kind of had this thought, well, he knew the lineages of a lot of these varieties, and he thought if he could just work on getting some durability in some of these varieties that he could create a market for California growers to export this fruit to Asia. So he started that, and then in the early 70s, they started working on rootstock. The Zagers were working on developing rootstock for stone fruit, and rootstock is the base tree kind of onto which varieties are grafted.
Right.
That's disease resistant. the more resistant tree that varieties are grafted onto. So just planting a tree.
Give us an example.
An example of
a rootstock and what's grafted upon it.
Well, let's see. There's some standard rootstocks that are now kind of popular all over. I think one of the classics is Nemagard. A couple of the Zagers rootstocks are Viking and I'm blanking on the name.
So these rootstocks are durable, they're resistant to bugs and diseases, and so they are much more preferred than natural rootstocks.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Okay. So what they do then is they take the favorable phenotypic response, like this delicious plum, and they chop the top half of it off and stick it into the rootstock, and away they go.
That's right.
Right.
Just graft a little of the wood onto the base rootstock, and then it can speed up the growing process and have a much healthier tree at the time.
So how does Zager go about developing a fruit variety? Does he do it with grafting? It couldn't be grafting because that's kind of like the finished product then, isn't it?
Right, that's the asexual propagation. And then the sexual propagation, the breeding, and each breeder, I think, has a slightly different technique. But the basic gist of it is that they take the blossoms from one tree, they call it the popcorn stage, before the flower has opened. And they'll grind that up and take the pollen from that, and then they'll dab it onto the flowers of another tree.
So all of Zager's work, then, in developing new plant varieties is done by hand. With paintbrush.
That's right.
And some pollen.
That's right. It's all done right there in the orchard, and it's all done by hand. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people have, you know, when you think breeding, you think genetically modified organisms, lab work, breaking down atoms, that sort of stuff. This is all just basically accelerating sort of the natural process that,
right,
that the bees would do in the field. Once you brush that pollen onto that flower. That happens January, February, March, depending on the weather. That summer, you take that fruit and you strip the fruit off of it, you germinate the seed, and then you try to grow the seedlings. And
see, the seedling comes up.
What's that?
And then you see what comes up.
See what comes up, that's right.
Hey, and folks, this is the Food Chain. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll pick up with Chip Brantley, who is the author of The Perfect Fruit, Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and The Hunt for the Elusive Pluot. How do you get a pluot out of a plum and an apricot? That's what we're learning about right now. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to make about fruit or fruit developing, 83-800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. Right back. So if you want to change the nature of something, you propagate it sexually. If you want to take that favorable nature and sell a bunch of them, you propagate it asexually. Fair enough to say that, something like that, Chip?
Oh, great. I wish I'd thought of that. That would have saved me a couple of pages.
All right, fair enough. And so, but that's what we're talking about right now, is changing the nature of plants and specifically fruits. And we're talking about the work of some very famous Americans like Luther Burbank and some not quite so famous ones like Floyd Zager. But Floyd has really become a legend in the fruit industry, certainly, right?
He has, yeah. He's the... one grower told a magazine one time he'll be in the encyclopedia one day, which I think is a great way of kind of summing up his contributions. He's one of those guys I think we'll look back on and say, had a huge impact on the food we eat. And, you know, there are other breeders in California who are also doing great work along those same lines. Fred Anderson, the father of the modern nectarine, his ranch was taken over after his death by Norman Bradford, who worked for Fred Anderson for a long time, and Norman's son Glenn Bradford is continuing that work, and they do a lot of great work with plums, peaches, and nectarines as well.
Good. And so what we're looking for, of course, is a way of putting flavor back into the fruit that has become essentially emasculated, if you will, if I can use that word, by the needs and requirements of the mass market. What we were looking for were fruits that would travel many thousands of miles and last days and weeks and months, and like the Red Delicious apple, and what we ended up with was fruit that didn't have any taste in it. And so that's what we're looking to do, is put fruit flavor back into the fruit, and we do that with sexual propagation by taking out the paintbrush and collecting a little bit of pollen and dabbing it on the flowers. Now, describe what Floyd's nursery looks like, because his mother plants, his mother trees, are not in the ground per se, are they?
They're not. Well, some of them are, but the bulk of them are in large blue container tubs their work, the Zager's work is running a plant nursery kind of led them to this idea, which was rather than having to go out into the orchard in February when the weather's temperamental and can't control the temperature and could be raining and you could have to drive from one end of the orchard to the other to find a tree, they decided to put the mother trees in big blue container tins that would allow them to throw them on the back of a truck or on a trailer and drag them to where they could do the work all in one spot. Eventually, they built a greenhouse where they bring the fruit in to do the crossing inside. They can control the temperature. They can, of course, put a roof over their head so they don't get rained on.
Mm-hmm.
It makes for a much better work environment for the people doing the work, but it also gives them a kind of an upper hand when it comes to getting the conditions right to breeding the fruit.
Good. Let's go to the phones. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Here's Chili Bob. Welcome to the Food Chain, Chili.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Good. Welcome aboard.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about flavor in all of our fruits and in vegetables, too.
Right.
Over the past years, we've seen a decline in flavor, and it's mostly because of shelf life, storability, shipability, mm-hmm. the life of the commodity. And what I've seen over the years is varieties that I've had of celery, cauliflower, tomatoes that used to be really sweet, but they wouldn't ship anywhere. So So what it is the sugar content. It's basically a simple equation. The more sugar and the sweeter a fruit or vegetable is, the less shelf life it's got. Sugar just breaks down. And so that was the victim in the transformation of taking something and giving it a shelf life. Was taking the sugar out of it, and so the varieties that have less flavor basically will ship better and they'll store longer, and that's what they're after. It's unfortunate, but that's just a fact. Now, if the geneticists could find a way to put sweetness back into something and still maintain the shelf life, then we've got something. But until then, I think we're kind of doomed to bland vegetables and fruits.
Wow, Chip.
Well, I think you're right. I hope you're wrong that we're doomed to bland vegetables and fruit. But I think you're right in describing what's happened over the years. And I think that's one area where people have even Floyd Zegers and detractors have said that he's made a big improvement in restoring some of the sugar to these more durable varieties, or using more durable varieties in the breeding program to try to get...
Well, you know, and also, not to interrupt you, but as a grower, I'd much rather see something that doesn't have that much shelf life, because we'd have a better turnover
right.
of fruits and vegetables.
Amen.
And, you know, instead of having a 2 or 3 week shelf life, it would have a week or 10-day shelf life, and that means they'd have to get rid of the stuff quicker and replace it with stuff that we're growing more,
right.
so we could grow more of this stuff. But...
Well, isn't that the curse of the Red Delicious apple? I mean, it was beautiful. It traveled. It maintained its freshness for months and months and months. And so the market crashed because the apples were there forever.
Right. Well,
and when you buy the Red Delicious apple, you bite into it. It's beautiful. But when you bite into it, it's nothing there.
Right. Well, I think that's, you know, it's interesting about shelf life, because I see some pluots now, you know, being back east and down south, some pluots that stay on the shelves. One of my hobbies is to go into grocery stores and monitor produce departments. And I'm, you know, one of the it's amazing how long they leave pluots on the shelves. And that's actually one of the criticisms that the Zegers have gotten for some of their varieties.
Is that
they're just sweet. You know, that's all they are. They don't have any flavor. It's kind of the opposite of the Red Delicious problem, which is...
We're going to have to take a quick break. Right back, we'll pick that up. Chili Bob, thanks for the call. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. We're in search of the perfect fruit with Chip Brantley, the author of The Perfect Fruit, Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and The Hunt for the Elusive Pluot. We were talking a little bit about sweetness and how the Floyd Zeger people have often been accused of having pluots that are just sweet. And producer Carol Stafford came running in and said, well, that's kind of like the Fuji apple problem, too. They're just sweet, don't have any character.
Right.
How much of the character and taste comes from the environment?
Well, I think, that's the kind of underlying, you know, anytime you talk about fruit, as you all know, you have to talk about the ground the fruit is, the
right.
tree is grown
right.
on, that season, the climate, what the weather's like that particular season. So there are all sorts of things that the grower just can't control. And that I think is the underlying problem, I guess, with fruit growing of any kind, the challenge. It's not necessarily a problem, but I think that's one thing that, you know, in talking to growers and also talking to retail buyers, that I think a lot of the marketplace, whether it's the people, the grocery stores buying the fruit, or the consumers buying the fruit from the grocery stores, we don't think about, you know, it's not our problem. We tend not
right.
to think about the challenges that the grower has to
just bring me the product and quit talking, right?
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you this, the big question, of course. The Zegers have been working at developing plants for a long, long time, and they really are kind of reaching for the brass ring of horticulture, of the business of horticulture, that they're trying to get the most they can out of their labors. What's next for them? They've come up with a pluot. What else do they have up their sleeves?
Well, they've, for some time now, have been... crossing other stone fruits. They've got a fruit they call a picatum, which is a peach, apricot, plum, And just
they're bringing three different things together.
That's right. Apparently, that they're able to make generational crosses that combine all three of these fruits, and eventually one would think even more, trying to combine kind of the best qualities of each of these things. And was just emailing with somebody at the Dave Wilson Nursery this week, and he was saying one of the things he was most excited about this season was what they're calling cherums.
Cherums.
Which is
a cherry and a plum or something?
A cherry and a plum. Are you kidding? I'm not kidding.
Cherry and a plum?
Apparently, plums and cherries apparently are very closely related in terms of their profile, their genetic profile. So I think, all these stone fruits, peaches, plums, nectarines, cherries, apricots, they're all very closely related. So many people even think they have a common ancestor. So not too hard to imagine that we could continue combining them until we create some combination of all of them.
Is there any limit? Given the tools of genetic engineering, is there any limit?
Well, in terms of the genetic engineering, the lab side, that I don't know about. But in terms of the hand breeding, what the Zegers
right.
do, what other plant breeders do, fruit breeders do, you're basically stuck within your genus.
Within your family, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. So there it is, just like people, I guess. So hopefully that's the case at any rate. Hopefully we won't be crossing ourselves with any other critters. Folks, this has been The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we've been talking with Chip Brantley, the author of The Perfect Fruit, Good Breeding, Bad Seeds, and The Hunt for the Elusive Pluot. Great story. If you like food, pick it up. You'll love it. It's a good taste. Thanks, Chip. Really appreciate you joining us. And
have a great time, Michael. Thanks.
Thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.